Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Kip Casper, Clone Radio, LA's infinite repeat. How we feeling out there? How's your drive time commute? I need a saga. What's the saga? It's songs for the deaf. You can't even hear it. This ain't worth a dollar, but I feel like a millionaire. From their third album, Songs for the Deaf, released on 27th of August 2002 by Interscope Records, Queens of the Stone Age, of course.
They make me giggle.
I always think about Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. I'm sure
indeed.
They wouldn't appreciate the reference, but
they are amazing. Do you know what? They're so full of surprises. It's just, I've just giggled all the way through that track.
It's when it stops at the end and it's complete and it comes back anyway. It's such a ferocious sound. And the thing about Josh Homme is that his guitar sound, and this is one of the reasons why we picked this one. I mean, his guitar sound is so unusual. It doesn't sound like a heavy rock band. I mean, obviously that great big driving guitar, that's very, very heavy, but it's like his lead sound. If you got that in the studio, you'd be pushed to want to record it because it sounds very odd. It's like a weird, but it's perfect. And that is the reason why I think they've done so well, because he's a great songwriter. He's a great producer. I mean, he's produced a lot of things. Did the Arctic Monkeys, you know, which really changed their sound, you know, completely later on.
Yeah.
And but he's got just a completely different take on heavy rock. I mean, they call this stoner rock, don't they? They call it what is desert that about? Rock. I don't know what desert rock is. I know what desert boots are.
No. Well, there was a guy, Chris Goss, apparently, who produced the album, and he's known as the godfather of desert rock. And I'm wondering, is it because you've got to be surrounded by sand?
I don't know. Very good. I don't know.
We have sound in the stands when you have your speakers, don't you?
Yeah.
Just to try and stop the vibration from the floor. But, I mean, I don't really know anything about Queens of the Stone Age, so this is what all music have to say about this album, right, mm-hmm. which it makes me laugh. They were so concerned with pleasing themselves with what they play, they don't give a damn for the audience. Right? This is great. This extends to the production, with the entire album framed as a broadcast from a left of the dial AM radio station. The sonics compress so every instrument is flattened. It's a joke run wild, punctuated by an ironic mock DJ, and it fits an album where the players run wild.
Well, yeah, I mean, Nick Oliveri on No One Knows, that bass solo with him, he's got a Thunderbird. We have played that track, I think, quite a few programs ago. But but it's an amazing sound. And the first time I heard it, of course, like everybody does, is that when it first comes in, you want to turn it up and you suddenly get like really quiet and you turn to hear those drums. You think, well, that's a bit odd. And all of a sudden it comes in and you, wow. And I was driving, I remember swerving all over the road. I had to turn it down quick before it blew my head off, you know, and blew the speakers up.
Well, I've worked out where their influence comes from that opening, you know, with this sort of radio DJ.
Yeah.
It's obvious.
Go on.
We've been observing your Earth and we'd like to make a contact with you. It's obvious. It's the Carpenters and calling occupants of interplanetary craft.
Well, it's not obvious to me. Well done.
Tenuous.
Tenuous, very tenuous. But, Eric Valentine was placed as producer of this by Interscope, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And Josh wasn't happy.
No, apparently they didn't think he was producing them. He was just literally recording them. So obviously they didn't get on from an artistic producer kind of relationship. Mm. So they sacked him off.
I think he's very troublesome. I mean, Nick Oliveri is very troublesome, I know. But I mean, he left the band, sadly, because I don't think they've ever been the same since he went.
No.
But of course, on this is Dave Grohl on drums as well.
Oh, no, this is weird.
Which is fantastic. I mean, and he really does add some tremendous power to it. And of course, about the same time, he did that thing with Tenacious D.
Oh, of course. I mean, the Grohl. I mean, what I think of with him is that he seems such a good guy to hang out with and fun guy. And like, he just gets into all these really obscure projects. I mean, he knew Josh Homme for like 10 years before he got to play on this album. So they were mates anyway. Yeah. I think it's great.
Well, it is. And it definitely adds something. But the chemistry between them all on this record, it's amazing. I know it's quite old now and stuff, but it's just one of those things that just grips you.
I think it's quite vivacious.
As the crow flies, baby, well, I ain't too far from you. As the crow flies, baby, well, I ain't too far from you. Yeah, but since I don't have wings, well, I can't get home as fast as I want. Thank you. dreamed last night. Well, I heard you call my name. In a dream last night. Well, I heard you call my name. Yeah, I took it as an omen, and I jumped on a very fast freight train. As the crow flies, baby, well, I ain't too far from you. Get home as fast as I want.
Tony Joe White, As the Crow Flies, from his fifth album, The Train I'm On, which was also his second release on the Warner Brothers label.
That sounds like it was recorded yesterday.
Do you think so?
Yeah. The production is, again, sensational. It's beautiful. Recorded at Muscle Shoals and produced by a combination, a fierce combination of Tom Dowd, who's one of our favourite producers of all time, and the mighty Jerry Wexler.
It's a hit.
Print it. He's fantastic. 1972.
Yes.
It sounds fantastic. There's loads of dynamic range in it, and that tremolo guitar. And as soon as I heard it again, because it's a long time since I've heard this record, but I dug it out. Because we're really delving into our collection now. And, you know, it sounds very much like Oh Mercy, Bob Dylan, produced by Lanwa. Lanwa's been listening to this. And he's got that, it's got that thing, but it's very clean, very beautiful. Great.
And they call it, like, he's supposed to be an icon of swamp rock. Does that mean that you have to be surrounded by swamps?
Alligators up to your arse in alligators.
Who makes these terms up? I don't know. It's just crazy. I had a look into Tony Joe White's story, you know.
He passed away recently, didn't he?
Yeah. And this is, and it's great, you know, to share his music because I don't really know him. But I tell you, he just feels like he's in the room with you and he's a storyteller. You know, I believe him.
Yeah.
He's alive in his music. You can feel it, can't you?
It's got a bit of a J.J. Cale thing going on, hasn't it, you know?
Yeah.
1972. And the string arrangements on the album were done by Arif Mardin, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Who was like a massive, you know,
super
massive
talented
producer. Yeah.
More talented than George Martin.
Ooh.
Well, they say that because he was scoring this left area, played everything.
Yeah.
They did. They did say that, actually. Did it? And when you look at his work, I think that...
Oh, he worked with everybody, Arif Mardin.
Of course he did. Yeah.
But anyway, but back to Tony...
Tony Joe White. Yeah. Now, I looked into this because, you know, it's always beautiful just to know a little bit about somebody. So he was born on July the 23rd in 1943 in a place called Goodwill in Louisiana. Doesn't that sound beautiful?
Amazing.
And he was born into a part Cherokee family and grew up on a cotton farm. And he began working in nightclubs in Texas during the mid-60s. And by 1968, he moved himself to Nashville. And he signed a deal with Monument Records and released four singles, but none which were really successful in the United States. But there was a single called Soul Francisco. It was a hit in France.
Blimey.
Now, that got me thinking as well, is that, you know, you go where the music connects and you might have an audience in America that won't get your music, but then an audience in France, it'll be just right. And you can never tell. This is the thing. You can never tell where your music's going to collect.
Well, I mean, you know, Barclay James Harvest, because a good friend of ours, a drummer who we've worked with a lot, Kev Whitehead, he plays with Barclay James Harvest, or one incarnation of them at the moment. And, you know, they've been massive in Germany for years. And they were selling albums for years. And, you know, in England, they just sort of died. Because when punk happened, all that progressive rock and rock thing just disappeared. But, you know, there are places where these things still sell a lot, you know. And again, it must be just some connection with the culture or something. I don't know.
Fascinates me. Do you want me to carry on? I've got a little bit more of a story here with Tony Joe. So he wrote a song called Polk Salad Annie.
Yeah.
As in Polk.
Yeah.
I don't know. And this is another thing. So they'd released this single. It had been released for 9 months and the record label had written it off as a failure. And it finally entered the US charts in July 1969 and climbed to the top 10 and eventually got to number 8, and it was his biggest hit. So for 9 months, it was and then suddenly it connected.
Yeah.
And got up the charts.
Well,
yet again.
With re-releases. I mean, re-releases, you know, they'll release it 12 months later and all of a sudden, bang, it goes, you know. Mm. Very odd.
So anyway, in conclusion with his career as well, just he's toured with Steppenwolf, Sly and the Family Stone, Creedence Clearwater Revival, and other major rock acts in the 70s. He co-produced a track for Tina Turner, wrote the song Steamy Windows on her 1989 album Foreign Affair.
Well,
let's get in there, Tony Joe.
Steamy windows.
I know. I actually had to just double check because I thought it was steaming windows. And I went, oh no, that's not quite right. And as I carry on, as it does happen, I'm terrible typist because I deliberately didn't learn to type so I could never get a job as a typist. But I didn't realise just how much keyboard skills can help later on.
Yeah, I know.
But it's like, you know, don't learn to cook. You don't ever have to do it. Anyway, we'll that you could go on that one. Going back to Tony, though, in the 90s, he toured Germany and France with Joe Cocker.
No.
And Eric Clapton.
No.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, this guy's serious. And in 2013, he was on the Live with Jules Holland show.
No.
Beautiful. And I know I've been hogging this one, but you know I've got one more thing as well because beautiful. And
I don't
know
this.
We celebrate. I just want to find out more about Tony Joe, but I think this is a beautiful way to conclude this. On October the 15th in 2014, Tony Joe appeared on The Late Show with David Letterman alongside the Foo Fighters to perform "Polk Salad Annie." Now, so Letterman pointed to Tony Joe and told the TV audience, "Holy cow, if I was this guy, you could all kiss my ass. And I mean that."
Conquistador, your stallion stands in need of company. Like some angel's haloed brow, you reek of purity. I see your armor-plated breast has long since lost its sheen. And in your death mask face, there are no signs which can be seen. Though I hope for something to find, I could see no place to unwind. Conquistador, vulture sits upon your silver sheen. And in your rusty scabbard now, sand has taken sea. And though your jewel encrusted blade has not been plundered still, the sea has washed across your face. Pay my respect. Though I came to jeer at you,
Procol Harum, Conquistador, from their album, Procol Harum, first studio album, released in September 1967 on the Durham label in the USA, following the huge success of their breakthrough single, A Whiter Shade of Pale, produced by Denny Cordell. What it doesn't mention on Wikipedia, and I'm going to go on here.
Okay, go on.
Right, Tony Visconti was kicking around at the time as well.
My mate Tony.
Yeah, Tony Visconti was actually working with Denny Cordell because Denny Cordell brought him across from America and he was actually kicking around these sessions on the Whiter Shade of Pale. And what he did is Denny Cordell got Visconti to go and produce other people while he was working on, because he was really busy, you know.
Wow.
That's what happened. Anyway, back to Procol Harum.
Wow, who are Procol Harum?
Well, Gary Brooker. You know, I love that guy's voice. What a Shade of Pale. I mean, I saw him on Late for Jules some years ago, and his voice, and he's not a young man though, you know, and his voice was just as good. And it made me cold, you know, when he did White Shade of Pearl, because it's just beautiful. It's a great, you know, great. And he's a piano player, because everybody always thinks he plays the organ, but he doesn't. He plays the piano, and there's a different organ player.
Yeah. And really?
Yes. Oh, yeah, separate. Well, the organ player was the guy that sued him for actually writing part of White Shade of Pearl.
I haven't connected that, you know. I've been a bit busy recently.
Have you? What have you been doing?
Oh, just touring, playing. Press releases. Wow.
Yeah, I know.
But do you know Whiter Shade of Pale sold over 10 million copies?
Yeah.
It's just huge. And you write about his voice. Remember when we saw him on the TV, he was in a festival and it looked like sort of come kind of some Victoriana throwback festival. It was very respectful
home,
and everybody
yeah.
was sat in, you know.
He was magnificent.
Gold-plated deck chairs type affair with stripes. Yeah. But he sent goose pimples on your skin. You just even through a screen and here at home, you could hear, you could feel him, couldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
He was amazing.
Magnificent. And, of course, on this album is also Robin Trower, the very famous Robin Trower guitar player who went to school with Brooker.
Oh, right? Of course.
And he started a band, and then after Whiter Shade of Pale, he joined full-time until, I think, 1971, 1972, when he went out on his own. And again, you know, a magnificent guitar player. You know, I love that guy. But he never really shone as a soloist or a guitar player on these things. You can hear little snippets of his playing, but it doesn't sort of come out until he went out on his own, really.
I think you're slipping a bit today as well, because there's something you've neglected to say, and you always love to mention it whenever it occurs.
The fact that you're called Olympic Studios. Yeah. I was just about to come to that. You see, I'm like a. When it comes to Olympic, I think I'm becoming a very serious authority on this.
I'm going to have to get you some underpants that are printed with the Olympic Studios on or something. We'll have the studio underwear line. Shall I put on my Trident today? Shall I have my Olympic? That's actually a really good idea. I know, today I feel like Abbey Road.
Oh dear, oh dear. And the Wessex sound can be a bit tight around the gusset. Oh dear, we better move on.
I don't know, maybe Delaney Lee on a Sunday.
Some tears I can't cry them anymore. I can't think of what they're for. Oh, they ruin me every time. But I'll try. Someday position. Your eyes catch the light with promises that might come true for a while.
Lonesome Tears by Beck. That's from his eighth studio album called Sea Change, and it was released on September the 24th in 2002 on the Geffen label.
Now, you dug this one out, didn't you?
I did. I love this song.
Because believe it or not, I've not heard it.
No. It's weird, isn't it? That we both hear different songs. Well, we don't know. I mean, no, it's probably just life. But, do you know, I so love this song. The feel... If ever you've been hurt, and most of us, all of us have, I'm sure, that it feels like the pain that I felt. You know, I hear it, I feel it in him, and especially in the chorus, and it's just, you just don't feel like you're on your own. You suddenly feel like there's somebody else in the world who really knows the depth of how you hurt without having to say words, if you know what I mean. It's not just the fact he sings the lyrics, it's the feel of the emotion of the music.
Well, Nigel Godrich produced this, who's, of course, Radiohead's producer, yes, and collaborator. He also played keyboards on this.
Yeah.
And I've got to say, I mean, the interweaving of those keyboards and the string sounds, old sample probably, they are sample. And, it's magnificent. And at the end, there's almost a bit of a shout-out to George Martin From the Day of Her Life, you know where course. It all goes into that cacophony thing. Yes. You know, and he's pulled the drums right back and it gets very, very, you know, dark and intense and slightly discordant and stuff in places. But, you know, the intensity of the song is amazing. Beautiful. I've always liked Beck and I like the fact he keeps changing, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, No Delay, when that came out, I remember listening to that. I was in Mexico at the time, believe it or not. Very odd, but I was. And it was, I was listening to it for the first time and it was like incredible.
It's obscure.
It is obscure, yeah. Well, yeah. And it was amazing. An amazing thing. And he's every time he's done stuff, he's always done stuff quite different. And that is so dramatic. And I'd say, you know, I mean, it sounds like a mature songwriter here. He's really, you know, there's no real, what's the word, tricks or you know, it's just a great song, really well produced.
You know? It's funny, you know, because David Frick from Rolling Stone actually said that it's the best album Beck has ever made. It sounds like he's paid dearly for the achievement. Mm. You can feel that in him. And the other thing I didn't realise until I researched this is guess who was playing drums?
Go on.
James Gadson.
No, not Gadson.
Oh, yeah.
Our favourite drummer of all
Our
time.
Our favourite drummer. We love James Gadson. In fact, he should go on Underpants series as well. We should have just James on Monday, Underpants. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
Yeah.
A guest drummer on the Sunday Pants.
Okay, that's cool.
But yeah, so that's, and see, James Gadson has such a cool, beautiful feel as well. That together, I think, with the sentiment and the and then the musicianship, and with, I mean, it's a dream team, isn't it? Absolutely, yeah. Dream team.
And that was recorded at Ocean Way as well, which we've actually been to in Nashville. We had a tour of it, didn't we? Great. Yeah. One of the most beautiful live rooms I've ever seen. It's in an old church, very, very high, and the sound in there is just delicious. You just want to lie in there on the floor on your back and just listen to music in there, you know, and make music. You know, I would love to record at that place, you know.
Well, funny enough, they had 2 months booked in to record the album, and they overran. And who was in next was Joni Mitchell.
Right.
But Joni liked to work in a really organised way, so they were nicking in on the weekends or she wasn't there to try and finish the album off.
Well, she did Monday to Friday.
Yeah, she was very organised. So whenever there was any downtime, they were in, like Flint. Quick.
So you can imagine on Friday night after the finish, they've got the pub, like, you know, looking home, and then you just have the weekend. That's great. Fantastic.
Situations we really know, but the knowing is in the mind.
You're listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was The Yardbirds, happening 10 years ago, released on the 21st of October 1966 in the UK on Columbia label and the 4th of November 1966 on the Epic label in the USA. And last night we watched, whilst in bed, the Jeff Beck documentary that was on the BBC.
Fascinating.
Brilliant.
Incredible. It was a great show.
And he was talking about the Yardbirds experience and everything. And how he left, he just sort of just packed up. He didn't want to do it. You know, he didn't go to Woodstock because he just didn't want to do it. He didn't think he'd do himself any favours and actually do a great performance, which is incredible. He turned down Woodstock.
That is incredible.
Yeah. When he was singing with, or when he was playing, I should say, with Rod Stewart on vocals in his band, you know, and Ronnie Wood on bass. But anyway, back to the Yardbirds, because, you know, they were an amazing band because they brought on three of the greatest guitar players, you know,
British guitar players,
that were all on that documentary last night. Yeah, and they were all saying how good Beck was, you know. It's Eric Clapton, of course, Jimmy Page. And Jimmy Page was waxing lyrical about Jeff Beck last night. I've never heard him so complimentary.
No, I was a bit surprised as well. He was just full of love and admiration, wasn't he?
Absolutely, you know. And how Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page used to hang out when they were young. He used to go and listen to albums because Jeff Beck, you know, didn't have a lot of money, I don't think, and Jimmy Page's parents did. So he went round to listen to the vinyl and had all loads of stuff, you know. But absolutely brilliant. But this track, I mean, it didn't do all that well, and it was towards the end of the career. But it was really experimented with this dual guitar thing.
Yeah,
loads of fuzz.
So there's Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page on
That's
dual
right.
guitar.
Yeah, a load of fuzz. And was John Paul Jones on this?
He was playing bass in the studio recording.
Yeah, because Chris Dezure had left, hadn't he? By then. Yeah, and he was playing. So obviously, it was like the beginning of Led Zeppelin, really.
Exactly. It's really surreal, you know, hearing this, because the attitude, you know, straight away, there's a texture. And, you know, we were talking when we went for a walk the other day about tone and fuzz, and I was saying, well, I'm not sure if I really like fuzz.
On bass.
Because I love fuzz on guitar, but not necessarily on bass. And it's really interesting as you start to listen to the textures now and how those textures were first introduced to music and how they changed the way people felt with the music as well. I do like a bit of fuzz, but I've just got to find my fuzz.
Yeah, it's very, you know, it is very aggressive. Yeah. But yet again, there's times when you just need to change that tone. So it does come out and go bang. Yeah, you know, incredible. But it's a great record, you know, and very interesting in its production. And it was produced by
our friend Simon.
Simon Epiodel, yeah.
Indeed. I know, so it's just, but it is a world of musicians and producers, and they are starting to feel a bit more like family as the shows progress, as I get to know people more, and then you think, oh, yeah, I know that person, and you're all connecting up, aren't you?
Well, that's right.
Step was, away from the, what have you got there?
I've got my book.
It's the Geek Book.
Yeah, the Great British Recording Studios by Howard Massey. And it's talking about Delane Lee Studios, which where this was recorded.
Yes.
Stroke Kingsway. And, you know, known principally for Floyd were in there, The Animals recorded there, and Deep Purple as well. You know, they were there a lot. So it was like a really cool place, you know, a cool place to hang out, apparently. Anyway, there we are.
Because the revolution's here, and you know.
Thunderclap Newman and Something in the Air releases a single in May 1969 and also on the album Hollywood Dream, released in 1969.
Produced by Pete Townsend.
Incredible.
Who was also playing bass.
Step away from the bass.
Well, it was very busy, the bass on that.
Yeah.
It was obviously played with a pick with flat-wound strings, and it was like poking you in the air.
I felt that too. I was going to actually mention the pick.
Yeah, it was busy, but it was kind of appropriate. It was interesting. But after playing with John Entwistle, of course, I suppose busy is his thing, you know?
That's true. Do you know what his pseudonym was? So you didn't know it was Pete Townsend playing. He went under the name of Bijou Drains.
Well, yeah, because of, copyright and all, yeah. You know, because he was signed to another label. Was he signed to Track as well? I don't know. It was released on Track Records, wasn't it?
I don't know.
I think so, yeah. And Kit Lambert, who was very much involved with The Who and that whole Track Records thing. Yeah. I think this was recorded at AdVision as well, Studios.
Get you. Throw it in there. 1, 2, 3, bang, bang, bang.
Yeah, well, I've just looked it up in my Bible of recording studios in the UK. I do love it. But, what I love about that song is it's a song of hope. It was 1969, so it was after the Summer of Love. It was after, you know, it was the... Because Summer of Love was very quick, wasn't it? It was a summer of love, and that was it.
Yeah, yeah.
You
know, and it wasn't the summer in autumn, was it?
Yeah, and that's right. And the whole 60s thing, you know, culminated for a bit, and then it all started to go downhill when, you know, there was more Class A drugs coming in, you know, and... And it really changed when it went into, like, the cocaine and heroin and all that. The whole scene changed, the druggy scene changed. And I think the hope and dream of what was great about the 60s sort of had fallen to pieces at this time, you know?
It's funny, it was number one for 3 weeks in the UK. And it replaced the Beatles from number one, who were number one at the time with the Ballad of John and Oko.
Oh, right.
And guess who they held off getting to number one?
Go on.
In the Ghetto by Elvis Presley.
No.
Yep. That's an achievement when you think about it. Isn't it funny, really?
It's a great song, though, this.
It is. And when you look into it, you think, well, who are Thunderclap Newman? And it basically says they were a British rock band that Pete Townsend of The Who and Kit Lambert had formed in 1969 because they'd found this guy, John Speedy Keen, and they wanted to showcase his talents. And they had Jimmy McCulloch and Andy Thunderclap Newman. And the concept was to create a band to perform songs written by Speedy Keen, who'd written Armenia City in the Sky, the first track on The Who sellout.
All right.
So they've got this writing and personal connection. So Pete recruited jazz pianist Andy Thunderclap Newman, who was a friend from art college. Do you know, and even on the documentary last night, Eric Clapton was saying that everyone was going to art college. They really enjoyed that couple of years where they could just...
As Jeff Beck did, yeah.
Indeed, and yeah, so...
And Eric.
And also the guys from Talking Heads and Tina Weymouth.
Oh, yeah.
They all met at art college.
Yeah.
And it's... Art college is a really cool place, you know. And so what happened as well was a 15-year-old Glaswegian guitarist, Jimmy McCulloch, subsequently he played lead, you know, guitar with Paul McCartney's Wings
for
a few years. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've got this whole thing going on. You go, hey, lad, you've got talent. Let's get a band together for you and let's get something out there. Brilliant.
Well, magnificent production again.
There's one thing, we'll close with this, because you know what? Or music, and it's sometimes I really like reading their synopses just so that you get a feel of them. They were saying, and there is a sadness as well with this whole kind of band, they were saying that in all these years and all these accolades later, it still seems incredible that Hollywood Dream meant nothing at the time of its release, that America let it drift no higher than number 161 in the charts, even though the UK actually got it, okay? And then less than a year before... After all, Something in the Air was topping the charts. Basically, when they had their next album out with Hollywood Dream, when they released the album after the single, they were just they were like chopping the charts before, and they said they were as close to Christmas as becoming the new Beatles. Instead, they weren't even the new Badfinger. And this exquisite LP that it was released on withered on the vine, and it was reissued in 1991. And Hollywood Dream had been utterly transformed by the admiration of so many subsequent listeners to stand alongside any lost classic you could mention among the finest albums of its psychedelic generation.
got a love song. Happy to have, not to have, not big businesses, very wise. I'm crossing over into enterprise. This is not a love song. 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 I'm adaptable now. I like my new.
Nouvelle Vague, This Is Not a Love Song, from their studio album Nouvelle Vague, surprisingly enough, released on the 9th of August 2004 on Peace Frog Records.
Perfect.
The UK record label included Jose Gonzalez.
No.
Smooth.
Smooth.
Bit too smooth for me, this.
Oh,
but
no,
you,
I like chose it. This one. I saw them live and at the Big Chill Festival years ago. And what I really loved about them is they came on, the two girls came on singing, and they were throwing roses out into the audience. And it was just such a different experience. And live, they were just fantastic. They were really
French.
Entertaining and just really, they made you feel good. And they just sang beautiful. And I think, you know, on a lazy Sunday afternoon, I think they're perfect for a festival.
It's definitely a very smooth sound. Completely different than the original version, of
course,
by Public Image Limited.
Exactly, but
our
isn't it lovely?
John Lydon. Yeah.
I like to have that interpretation of that. And it's a French band, by the way. They're formed by musicians Oliver Libo and Mark Collin. And they were originally going to do a cover of Joy Division's Love Will Tear Us Apart in a bossa nova style, and that's where the whole band thing came from. Would you believe?
Blimey.
I know, it's cool, eh?
Yeah. Well, you know what time it is, don't you? It's the time for the end of the show.
This is not funny.
It's terrible.
I didn't expect you to say that then. I thought you were going to tell me another interesting fact.
Well, if you want to contact us, we're on Instagram at Starlight Campbell, Twitter at Susie and Simon, and Facebook, of course.
And the show's available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio, and it's syndicated to loads of stations all across the world. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it seems to be doing very well. People are liking it, you know? We like it.
We like you guys too.
Yeah, we love it. So this is the last track for, and it's by Creation.
Now, the Creation is an English rock band formed in 1966, a very, very good year, 1966. And they're best known songs was like Making Time, which is one of the first rock songs to feature a guitar played with
a bow.
Indeed.
And we featured it a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago.
Exactly. So I was just reminding you there. And also, Alan McGee, did you know this? He named his record label after the band.
Well, I didn't know that. I knew, of course, I knew it was Creation Records, but I didn't realise that. That's fantastic. Well, Jimmy Page had a lot of great things to say about the guitar player, and his name escapes me. Phillips, is it?
Well, hang on. We've got Kenny Pickett and Fox. We've got Eddie Phillips, who's That's the him. Only surviving member of the band at the moment.
Yeah, and this is a pretty recent release, isn't it? 2013. But what I like about it, it's the production of it. It does sound very 60s. It's very forceful, very powerful. And he's clearly used the techniques that he did in those days, you know?
Yeah.
But he was renowned as Eddie Phillips, a great guitar player. One of the best around at the time. Better than Clapton, better than everybody, you know?
Well, I looked into it as well, you know, because you think it's a later release, but what they've done, they've just reissued it on vinyl. It was actually released in 96, this album, Power Surge. And here's a bit of triv for you. Kenny Pickett, who's in the band, guess what he's famous for as well? He co-wrote the album, the granddad song that Clive Dunn sang with Herbie Flowers.
Well, enjoy the Creation.